You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On today's show, we talk to Laura Wilkinson about making a living as a writer and about her new novel, That Night in New York. We talk to Charlie Ross, aka The Roaming Reader, about the new poetry slam, which she is starting over in Chichester. We talk to Simon Madrill about the pamphlet called Jonathan Blake L1, which is out with Polari Press and launches in Brighton on the 19th of February. And we also talk to Hannah Dolby, who is the author of No Life for a Lady and How to Solve Murders Like a Lady, which are set in Victorian Hastings. So we span Brighton, Chichester, Hastings, all across the coast in this episode of the show. If you have an idea which you'd like to pitch to us, you can send that in to btnbookclub@gmail.com. If you follow us on Instagram, you can do that at btnbookclub. And make sure that you subscribe to the Brighton Book Club podcast from wherever you listen to yours, so you can listen to the show at your leisure. Links to all the books and details of everything we talked about will be available over on our Instagram page at btnbookclub. I hope you enjoy the show. In a crazy Manhattan blackout, two lonely strangers connect. But can a passion forged in darkness survive the cold light of day? Steph, an advice columnist, is stuck in a stagnant life, while lonely architect Harry dreams of rediscovering his passion. Despite a chance encounter in New York sparking a magical connection between them, fear and past wounds keep them apart. But when Steph's daughter Lola enters the picture, their paths intertwine in unexpected ways. As Steph fights to save her community's beloved park and confronts her past, she must choose between safety and taking a leap of faith. That Night in New York is a heartwarming tale of love, family, and the courage to embrace new beginnings. And I am joined by Brighton-based author Laura Wilkinson on the Brighton Book Club. Laura, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. That Night in New York has such a gorgeous premise. Can you talk about the inspiration behind it?
Yes, of course. A really dear friend of mine lives in the East Village in Manhattan. She's been there for quite a long time. And I remember the 2003 blackout there. She was actually there, I wasn't. But I remembered her talking about it. And I thought, oh, that's such a brilliant premise for a meet cute, you know, the point in love stories where the two romantic leads connect with one another. And so I just sort of that slushed around in my head for quite a long time, as ideas tend to. But it was only fairly recently when I was scooching around for new ideas that I thought, actually, maybe I will go with that and see what emerges. So I, you know, I did what I usually do in terms of process, which is spend a little bit of time with the characters. I tend to sort of discover the characters whilst I'm also building a story, because I might be wrong, but it's my belief that people primarily pick up a book because they want a story, they want an emotional experience. But stories, you know, we've got so much competition these days, I would say, as authors, with the fantastic series that we get on so many of the streaming channels. So I feel that our stories have to be richer and more complex to be involving enough to keep people. So while I'm building out a story and checking out that it's got legs, I also work on the characters, because you've got to spend quite a long time with these people. So you've got to like them and you've got to feel passionate about your story. And so that, you know, the idea of the blackout pulling two people together in a way that's really difficult to escape from was the starting point. But then I'm British, obviously. I wanted to bring them back to the UK, and I needed to find some other source of conflict there. And I live in Portslade in Brighton, which is quite close to Benfield Valley. I don't know if you know the Benfield Valley, Anne.
I don't know.
Well, it's, I suppose it's about 15-minute walk away from me, but it's sort of labeled as one of the biggest and few green lungs in the city, in Brighton and Hove. And it's quite a wild area, but it's been under threat of development for a number of years now through various companies. And I have a couple of friends who are involved in the protests about trying to protect as much of that green space as we can, whilst also recognizing that there needs to be housing. So I'm inspired by that basically for the, you know, the other source of conflict between my two leading characters. You know, like a lot of people, I'm really interested in environmental issues. And I have two, they're grown-ups now, they're very boys, they're a very similar age to Lola, who is Steph, my leading lady's daughter. Lola is 17. And so housing and affordable housing is important to me as well. And I'm now just sort of thinking, oh, you know, sort of environment and housing makes it all sound really dry, but actually it's not. I mostly set out to write a very fun, entertaining story about two people who are very resistant to being together, but need to be together.
This is the perfect time, I think, for us to hear an extract. Can you read us some, please?
Yeah, of course. I'm going to read from really close to the beginning so that I don't have to explain too much. And I think it will become clear anyway. The story is written from both Steph and Harry's point of view, and I'm going to read a short extract from one of Harry's chapters. And Harry's on the way to Manhattan for work, and Steph has won the trip. As part of a competition, and they've been put next to one another on the plane, or strictly speaking, actually, they're just across the aisle from one another. And I'll just start reading, and hopefully, everything else will make sense. Harry says, "Is your trip business or pleasure?" "Pleasure," she doesn't sound sure. "Visiting friends?" "Well, not exactly. A friend was meant to come, but then they got sick, and I thought I'd come anyway." "Friend? Does she mean boyfriend?" "She must do." The redhead continues, "I'm not sure why now, to be honest." "For the adventure," Harry says. "I'm not what you'd call the adventurous type." She points at his open laptop with her fuchsia-painted nails. "Don't let me stop you working." "I'm not really, not at all, actually. Is this your first time in Manhattan?" She nods, guarded, and he launches into a monologue on how to get around, what's worth seeing, where to eat, where to steer clear of at night. He's totally wired. He drank way too many espressos. He sounds like a hyperactive travel guide, but he can't stop. Hours later, the plane begins its descent into JFK as the sun begins to set. And Steph asks Harry if it's easy to find the taxi rank, how much it might cost. "I left the planning to Tony. It's their superpower," she sighs. "How about you share mine? I've one booked." He isn't ready to say goodbye. He enjoys her company. He likes her, though he isn't sure the feeling's mutual. They'll have to say goodbye eventually, of course. But he wants to postpone the moment for as long as possible. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, as his mum would say. He watches her balance a long waiter's taxi rank against tolerating him for another hour or so. "Okay," she says. "A short ride, and you'll be shot of me for good." The cab slides towards the Queensboro Bridge. The island glitters like an open treasure chest in the inky sky. Steph gazes out of the cab window. Wow! Harry has forgotten how magical Manhattan is, how iconic and inviting, how thrilling. Sparkling obelisks, a mountain of light promising the world. It is the world. He's about to point out another landmark when the cat jolts, then judders to a crawl. He blinks, rubs his eyes. No, he's not hallucinating. Horns blare, hazard lights flash. The driver slaps the steering wheel, cursing. What just happened? Steph's voice is hardly more than a whisper. The Manhattan skyline is a silhouette. The moon and stars above outshine the city. The lights have gone out. Every last one. The city is dark.
That is such a wonderful extract. Thank you so much. I paused there because I was just so completely absorbed in your book. I think it's an absolutely great premise and your writing is beautiful. Laura, you've written seven novels. How do you keep your writing fresh and make sure that you're not reusing ideas or rewriting characters?
Oh, that's really funny that you asked that question because, yes, I've had seven books published, but I've actually just finished writing the ninth. And I'm so nervous about plagiarizing myself. not other people, but definitely myself. I'm constantly thinking, gosh, have I used this expression before? I think, in terms of ideas, that doesn't concern me because I guess I would describe myself as quite a curious person. I would say that most writers and readers are. You know, that's a lot of what drives us, a curiosity about the way that other people work, how people respond in certain situations, you know, what that reveals about them, about their hopes, fears, desires, etc. So I feel that because I've worked on a story, the premise, and I've worked on the characters, that I'm not too concerned about sort of repeating ideas, as it were. But in terms of, you know, phrases and it can be quite tough. But I suppose because I do have some experience now, as I've gone through my writing journey, I've become much more in tune with what my own tics are in terms of first drafts and that sort of thing. So my characters, for example, tend to shrug so much in first drafts. It's ridiculous. I mean, God, gosh, they're gonna have like neck ache. It's just terrible. And it's just that, if I feel I need to, I'll go back and have a quick scoot over old work, although I hate doing that because mostly I'm just feeling, oh, why did I do it like that? I could have done it so much better now.
That's very funny.
I don't know if you've heard this or read it somewhere, but I think it was Sadie Smith, who said it, that the best time to edit your work is 2 minutes before you're due to go on stage and read it. And that just so resonates with me. At things like festivals or book clubs or even, like this more, today speaking with you is, the copy of the book that I read from has got quite a lot of pencil scribbles all over it. So I don't know if I fully answered your question. I suppose the really truthful answer is I'm not entirely sure how I keep it fresh, but I think it's through finding a story that really excites me and characters that really interest me. That's the sort of the big picture. And I know because I've listened to the show, and lots of us writers will say it is that. What I have also become aware of, and I don't know, and I do, I've also been basically, it took me quite a long time, a shameful three books, before I realized that there are certain themes that slip through all of my books. You know, I would say that obviously most of them are love stories in one format or another, But missing parents tends to be in there. I'm sure lots of you out there will be able to work out why that might be. I am interested in things like the environment and the world around us and how we protect it, both for ourselves and future generations. And these themes, if you like, tend to seep through into all of my books. But what I sort of work hard at doing is trying to make sure that I come at it from a different angle via a completely different character who has their own view, emotional experience, baggage, and so on and so forth.
I think you've answered
Is
that
that
very well.
I was sort of thinking, have I answered that? I'm really not sure.
No, you absolutely have. Thank you. And it's great to hear about your process. So, Laura, one thing that I'm really interested in, as someone that kind of works in it, is the business of writing and the business of being an author and how you can, diversify your skill set and your career, because very few people realistically can write full time. The average income from a novelist is £7,000 a year, which is not enough to live on. So you have quite a varied career, don't you, in writing? Can you talk a bit about that and how that works for you?
Of course, yes, and yes, it made that latest survey, Society of Authors, makes for fairly grim reading, doesn't it? I mean, I've never been able to write full time, primarily for financial reasons, but also I'm not sure that I would want to write full time, if I'm completely honest. I like going out into the world and doing other things as well, which for me feeds into my writing work. So I'm portfolio, if you like, but I'm incredibly lucky and privileged that it is all connected with books and publishing and the writing world. So I teach on an MA. I'm an associate tutor, so I'll come in a few times a month and look at work and feedback on that. I do that at West Dean College, which is connected to the University of Sussex. I also run some short fiction writing courses there, and I lead an advanced writer's workshop for the Creative Writing Programme in Brighton, which is run by Cathy Haywood, who owns the Kemp Town Bookshop. I'm sure you know it. Really gorgeous bookshop. And I've done some teaching on the creative writing program as well. But I sort of came into the sort of tutoring via book doctoring and coaching. And this was very fortunate. As I say, I have been lucky, and I'm aware of my privilege there, that after my first novel was published, I was talking on a panel, and the room was full of readers and writers, and there were a few questions that were asked, and then the chair of the panel suggested that I might be good at being a book coach for literary consultancies like Cornerstones, the Writing Coach, the Literary Consultancy. And they very generously introduced me to Helen Corner, who runs Cornerstones Literary Agency. So I did like a sample report where emerging or new writers submit their work for someone who's a little bit further up the writing journey, published obviously, to sort of comment and feedback on the work that they've done, pointing out what's working and also pointing out the areas that they need to give extra consideration to or that aren't landing in the way that it needs to. So I did the sample report, and that went well, and then I was invited to do a lot more, and then I was invited to do some mentoring, which is a one-off one process. I mean, do you want me to explain a bit about what
Yeah,
mentoring
I
is?
think it might be really interesting for our listeners to hear what a book mentor. We're running slightly low on time, so if you give us a kind of like whistle stop tour of what mentoring with you could look like.
Yeah, okay. So the most common that I offer great flexibility with it, but the most common way that it looks is someone is working on a piece of fiction that they feel that they want someone who's more experienced than them to sort of walk beside them as they go through that journey. So once a month they might submit 7,000 words to me, which I will then read and comment on, and then we'll meet for an hour or so to brainstorm, to discuss areas, and to talk generally about the writing life. So it's basically your one-on-one personal support, somebody to bounce ideas off, share concerns, share the joys, so share the good stuff as well as the more difficult stuff. And I find that so rewarding, and I just love feeling like I've paid a small part in someone's journey to either just feeling like they are a better, more accomplished writer, and of course, to publication.
Absolutely. Nothing like seeing your name in the back of a book, is there?
It's just so, it's just so great when someone that you've seen working really hard, who's got talent, and to see them get to where they want to be. It's just fantastic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, Laura, you
Yeah.
are a writer in Brighton, as you said. What is it like being part of the community here? And what would you recommend people engage with if they're hoping to kind of join Brighton's writing community?
It's a fantastic community here, as you yourself know. I mean, there are a lot of writers here, and one of the best things about being in publishing is the fantastic people that you meet, yourself included. So if I was going to recommend, I would say, go to events at Waterstones, at the independent bookshops like City Books in Hove, and of course Kemp Town Bookshop that I've already mentioned. You can join New Writing South, which is an amazing organisation that will connect you with local writers. You can sign up to courses at places like the Creative Writing Programme or colleges like Westdean. I think there's also, I'm sure there are resources online at various writers groups. There's the Real Writers Club as well. And listening into shows like this, of course, will open up ideas and places where you can connect with other writers. And then there are the big sort of professional bodies like the Society of Authors or the Romantic Novelists Association or the Crime Writers Association. And they will point you in the direction of local groups if you need them. But certainly in Brighton, the ones that I mentioned earlier, the ones that I would sort of go to first of all.
Thank you so much, Laura. Laura, what is next for you? What are you working on?
I'm working on another love story. It's an epic love triangle between three very, very close friends. It involves an undelivered letter, a terrible accident, a mural in a dangerous place, and a coma.
Wow, not much then.
Going to say, pretty straightforward then at home.
Thank you so much for joining us, Laura. How can we find and follow you and get our hands on copies of your fabulous books?
Oh, thank you so much. Well, it will be in some bookshops. If it's not actually on the shelf, you can always order it. That's the Bricks and Mortars place. It is, of course, available on all the online stores as well. If you want to find me, I have my own website. It's laura-wilkinson.co.uk. I'm on Instagram, which is laura_wilkinsonwriter. Facebook as Laura Wilkinson author, and I am on X. I'm at Scorpio Scribble. I don't really do TikTok. I think I'm a bit old for that.
There's a lot of that on the
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really lovely talking to you.
I am joined by Charlie Ross, also known as the Roaming Reader, who joins us on the Brighton Book Club to talk about the new poetry slam which she is setting up in Chichester. Charlie, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me. It's good to be here.
Firstly, I would love it if you could tell us about yourself and also mention your Instagram page, The Roaming Reader, and why you are The Roaming Reader.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So, hi, I'm Charlie. I'm a performance poet, so I travel around performing in lots of different venues, and I'm trying to get a novel published and find a literary agent. And then, yeah, I'm the creator of the Roaming Reader Bookstagram, which started 8 years ago now. I can't believe it's been going that long. But yeah, it's a travel slash bookstagram where I talk about the places that I travel to. I always travel with a book in my handbag, so I just whip them out at locations and I talk about the book I'm reading and the place I visited. It's good fun.
It's an absolutely lovely page. I highly recommend following it. So before we talk about the poetry slam, it would be remiss of me not to ask you what your top read of 2024 was.
Oh, big question. Funnily enough, I was talking about this on my Instagram yesterday. I read this beautiful memoir called Gone by Min Kim, which it was so emotional. It's about a professional violinist who gets her £500,000 violin stolen in, I think it was St. Pancras Station. And it's about how she looks for it and gets it back eventually, and it's so emotional. Brilliant memoir.
And what are you looking forward to reading in 2025? What should be on our radars?
Oh gosh, so many. But the one I'm really excited about that's just come out is Think Again by Jacqueline Wilson. I'm a huge Jacqueline Wilson fan. She made my childhood. I met her and I couldn't speak. I was so starstruck. And so I'm very excited to try her adult work and see how that compares to her teenage novels that she produced eventually, originally.
I was just talking to a friend about this, Charlie. I am also a big Jacqueline Wilson fan, and I think it's going to be really weird, like going back into her writing as an adult. I think it's going to bring up a lot of stuff.
I think so. It's going to be strange, isn't it? It's been a while since I've read her. I think I was probably about 18, 17, probably when I last read one of her books. So, been a while.
Right. So let's get on to your poetry slam in Chichester. I want to know when you first had the idea to set this up and why Chichester?
Yeah, so I just think I love slam competitions. I've performed in quite a few myself, and they're such a warm, inviting environment, supportive, and everyone brings their A game. They're really, really exciting. But there aren't actually that many outside of London. There's one in Brighton, which I love and go to regularly, and then many, many in London. But outside of that, there's not actually that many. So I saw a real gap, especially in Chichester, because Chichester has a huge poetry community. There's four open mic nights for poetry alone. There's lots of music ones, but there's four just for poetry. So there's lots and lots of poets. There's obviously the creative writing students as well in the university. So we want to kind of bring all of that together, all of that creativity together into one place, bring all the open mic nights, all the creative people into one event. And we thought that was a real gap that kind of was missing to, yeah, just have this inclusive space where people can be themselves and, yeah, just something new and fresh, you know, that hasn't been done before in Chichester.
Absolutely. So, if I've never been to a poetry slam before and I'm 5 years old, can you explain what it looks like to me?
So it's funny because I think when people hear slam poetry, they're not really sure what it is, or they have an idea that it's got to be very rhythmic and very rhyming, almost like rap. But it's not like that at all. Anything can be a slam poem, so long as it's just your spoken word, like there's no music, no props. Anything can be a slam poem. And then it's basically an open mic night, really. And then you just get scored after your poem, which is more scary than it sounds, actually. It's quite exciting to see in real time how your poem goes down. But yeah, so it's just a 3 minute long poem. Some people bring two poems, they have 2 1 minute ones sometimes, but often it's a 3 minute long poem. And then, yeah, you get scored, and there's often about 10 competitors, and then the winner's announced at the end. And that's it.
How can people sign up to this? And what would you say to someone who is really nervous about coming and performing?
I would say if you're really, really nervous, because we've got a couple of heats. So if you're really nervous, come to the first heat in March. I think it's March 26th. It's the last Wednesday of March. Come to that, see what it's like, and then sign up for the next one, because we're doing the heats in March, April, and May. So you've got some time to kind of think about it, to explore the poetry, to write some poetry. So come along if you're nervous. If you want to compete, I would say at this stage we are going to have a link up, but at this stage, DM me on Instagram, the Roaming Reader. So you can ask any of your questions and I can give you more details that way. But at the moment, yeah, just get writing because you've got until March before the heat start. A 3-minute poem, any topic that you want, anything that you're burning to say, that's what I'd say. Yeah, get writing.
It's really, really inspiring. And I'd love to know a bit more about your personal story behind slam poetry. Were you writing poetry kind of in your bedroom and keeping it quiet for a while before you started performing it?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been writing poetry for about 10 years maybe, but I only started performing it 2 years ago. So I needed a new challenge. I turned 30. I was like, I need something to push me out of my comfort zone. And I decided performing poetry would be it, to get some of this poetry out into the daylight, because it very much, I was just keeping it in notebooks and not showing anyone. So I started with open mic nights. I went my first ever open mic night. I went to one in Edinburgh during the Edinburgh Fringe, which was a great time because it's so full of creativity during the Fringe in Edinburgh. And I loved it. So then I came back home and I found a regular open mic night to start going to. And then I got started in, I was invited to go to gigs and performing gigs and private events. And then I started slam competition, going to slam competitions. So it all kind of rolled on very organically, which is really fun. And it's interesting how my voice has kind of changed. So now my poetry is much more comedic, I think. It's quite rhythmic and rhyme and comedy, which I wouldn't have expected at all. Originally, it was very, oh, woe is me kind of poetry. But yeah, it's changed a lot since performing.
Charlie, thank you so much for joining us. If you are interested in hearing more about Charlie's Poetry Slam in Chichester in March, April, and May, make sure you are following the Roaming Reader, where you can find links to the event. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Thank you so much.
Simon Madrill joins us to talk about the pamphlet which he's written, which launches in Brighton on the 19th of February as part of LGBTQ History Month. Jonathan Blake L1 is out with Polari Press. Simon, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much, Anna. Delight to be here.
So, this compelling verse memoir tells the story of Jonathan Blake, born in 1949. Jonathan has lived through all of the major advances in and challenges to LGBTQ plus lives in the UK, including the AIDS global epidemic. Jonathan was one of the first to be diagnosed with HIV in 1982, so early that he was named patient L1 at London Middlesex Hospital. Jonathan shared 39 years of his life with Nigel Young, both of whom were members of Lesbian Gays Support the Minors, immortalised in the film Pride. Created from dozens of interviews, Simon has crafted, in Jonathan's voice, a moving tribute to an extraordinary life. Simon, how did this pamphlet come to exist?
Well, I saw Jonathan perform at a play by Patrick Cash called The HIV Monologues. The performance I saw was at the Ace Hotel in Shoreditch. And obviously it rang the bell with Dominic West playing him in Pride. But primarily, it just struck me that his story was so extraordinary, it needed to be told. And, you know, I mean, I think one of the sad symptoms of the HIV/AIDS epidemic is that many of those stories, the threads of stories that normally pass through the queer generations, so many of them were severed during the 80s and 90s. And a lot of the younger queer people nowadays, or even not so young queer people nowadays, are unaware of some of these stories. So it sort of fits with the trilogy I've done with Polari Press. The first one being Isle of Sin, which told the story of the gay rights campaigner Alan Shea, because the Isle of Man only legalized sex between men in 1992. But also tells the story of Dursley McLinden, who was an inspiration for Arlie Alexander's character in It's a Sin. And Dursley was born 6 months before me in the same hospital, but died of HIV/AIDS in 1995. And then my last book last year was to celebrate 30 years since the death of Derek Jarman, who was one of the probably the highest, the first high profile person to be open about his HIV status way back in 1996. Sorry, 1986, and he died in 1994. So this, yeah, so that it's part of that sort of desire to tell queer stories.
It's absolutely wonderful, and I highly, highly recommend looking at Simon's previous pamphlets as well as this forthcoming one. Can you read us some, please, Simon, from the new one?
Yeah, sure. I think the best one is like the first poem, which sort of sums up, is sums up the book or Jonathan, really. And it's called Recollections May Vary. As this is my memoir, expect words like Jonathan, Blake, nay Goodman, 1949. Expect sex, a lot of, you think of nothing else but bottom. Dom is only half of it. Expect drama school, synagogue, cottages, stages. As this is memoir, expect prep school, expect smells like isht, magnolia, vanilla, lemon drizzle cake, sweat, charcoal, burnt of course, twisted hazel, climbing hydrangea, Nigel the other half, for half of it. As this is memoir, expect Mother Goose traipsing lawns in tragic togas, expect Rose Bruford's knickers, Tybalt slain by Romeo, from a far country, maths, woodwork, cricket, useless bats, the gardener, the caretaker. As this is memoir, recollections may vary. The guilty or innocent beyond doubt, the innocent guilty, Joe, Joff, Jonty, Johnny, to name the usual suspect. Yellow, red, pink. Triangles, upturned, act up, facing down, AZT fingers, DDI toes. As this is memoir, I'll walk like a gorilla, sleep like a corpse, expect death, and you'll get it. Soon enough, I'll be patient L1. Patient L2 is dead. HIV, AIDS, it does that. As this is memoir, I'll schmize, I'll sext with strangers who turn out to be frauds. Some have drugs, others don't turn up. For all that, I'll live a lot longer than you think.
Thank you so much, Simon. I would love to hear about the process of writing this with Jonathan. How did it work?
Well, basically, I recorded in between 2019 and 20, recorded about 40 hours of interviews with him. And then this year I've done probably about another 10, because I was trying to get some Arts Council funding for it. So I've used those interviews. I've also interviewed some of his family and close friends. And I also had access, which is really for the book that will come, but I had access also to some interviews that were done by the British Library in 1991 of Jonathan as well. So that sort of has added to it. So it's really from all of that material I've come up with poem ideas, and a lot of the time it's just a little a snippet of a story or a an image that has then prompted me to write about something. In some instances, it's more of a it contains a lot more of Jonathan's voice, but it they're not what we would call found poems, if you like. They're more poems inspired from a much more holistic approach of getting to understand Jonathan and where he is and trying to create that emotional landscape that he's travelled through over 75 years. And the and the pamphlet hopefully will sell what in the end will be a very big book. I mean, the long term intent is to have Patient L1, The Life of Jonathan Blake in 10 acts, with a prologue and an interlude. So it's going to be 100, this is 26 poems. I've written about 50, and there will be probably 150, 200 in the final book. And
Wow.
Jonathan, of course, approves all of the poems. And to be honest, occasionally you'll have a an observation about something, and we'll fiddle around with it because it doesn't resonate with him, or there's a fact that he feels is important. But in the main, he's trusted me to capture him, which is wonderful.
It's amazing and a huge honor. Simon, what can we expect from the launch on the 19th of February, and how can people come along?
Yeah, well, we're actually going to make it sort of like a 40, 45-minute performance, really. So in this case, Jonathan is going to read most of the poems. I'll be doing little interludes within it, and sort of in the middle of it, there's a special surprise that I'm not going to tell you what it is. But there's a I'm going to be reading a set of poems that really fit with the thing. So it's going to be a sort of a yeah, a double-handed performance. But in this case, particularly because we're at Lunch Positive, it's a chance to hear Jonathan speaking his story. Whereas a more traditional book launch, we might do like a reading at Kemp Town Bookshop, for example, we're doing in March. That will be me reading the poems. And then there'll be a obviously, hopefully people will have questions for Jonathan afterwards. So there'll be time for that as well. You can just turn up on the 19th at 7 o'clock. There will be a probably an OutSavvy link going up on social media, as a sort of a pay what you can option, with all of the money from the tickets going in aid of Lunch Positive's wonderful work. Yeah, and you can find me on at Simon Madrill, which is double D double L, on sort of all social media, just one word.
Simon, thank you so much for joining us, and congratulations again on the publication of this very, very important pamphlet.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Violet Hamilton is a woman who knows her own mind, which in Victorian Hastings can make things a little complicated. Hannah Dolby is the author of the Hastings set cozy crime books, No Life for a Lady and How to Solve Murders Like a Lady, which are both out now with Head of Zeus, and she joins us to talk about the series. Hannah, welcome to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much.
It's great to have you here, and I'm going to put you on the spot and ask you to tell us about No Life for a Lady and How to Solve Murders Like a Lady.
Course, so they are two books. They work very much together, but you can read them separately. And they're about a Victorian lady detective. And the first one is really about her journey to becoming a detective, and the second one is about a case of a murder case that she solves. And the key thing about them, I think, is that they're funny and they're light-hearted. And Violet Hamilton, my heroine, is very quirky and gets herself into all sorts of adventures and shenanigans. And it's very much set in Hastings, so there's lots to discover about Victorian Hastings as well.
Why did you decide to set them in Hastings? What appealed to you?
I actually studied journalism there. It must be about 30 years ago now, and stayed there, lived there for 6 months. And it always stayed with me as such a beautiful place Hastings, and very much of that was down to its kind of crumbling Victorian grandeur, and that you got the real sense of what it must have been like as a Victorian seaside resort. And so it stayed with me a long time, and when I was looking for a setting for my novel, it came back. And obviously I knew it well because I'd spent that time there, but I've had many journeys back since.
Can you read us an extract, please?
So my heroine in the first book, she has a detective, but he turns out to be a little bit unsavory, so she's trying to fire him because she's found another detective. So this is where the extract, chapter 9, begins. Lying was utterly wicked, of course, but sometimes being a female required it. I called on Mr. Knight the very next day and told him another detective was taking over my case. I had tried to write a letter because I really did not want to see Mr. Knight again, but it did not have the firmness, the decisive quality I needed. I realized I had to go and see him, even though all of me quailed at the thought. He was not expecting me, and when I went to his office, he had his feet up on the desk and he was looking at pictures of my mother again. At least I thought he was, but when I came in, he threw whatever he was perusing in his desk drawer and slammed it shut, swinging his feet to the floor. "Miss Hamilton," he said, "an unexpected surprise. Take a seat, take a seat. You have come to tell me about your mother. Wait, let me get my pen and ink." He bent down and started rooting around in a lower drawer. "No," I said, "no, there is no need." My voice was a little raspy, so I cleared my throat. He sat up, clutching the pen and inkstand, placing them on his desk, and then dived back down and brought out some sheets of paper. "No," I said again, I said again, "I have decided I'm going to hire another detective." He stopped dipping his pen in his ink and stared at me. "Two detectives?" "No, I'm going to dispense with you. I mean, your services. I'm cancelling your services." Why was I so weak, so woolly? He gave a short laugh and threw down his pen. "Miss Hamilton, you cannot do that. You cannot hire a detective and then fire him."
Thank you so much, Hannah. It really gives a good sense of the character of Violet. And I'd really like to know when the idea of Violet came to you and if she always was going to exist in the Victorian era.
I think I started very much with the idea of a character who is a grown-up lady but is hampered by the innocence that was expected of you in the Victorian era. So she's very naive. She's 28, but she is very innocent about life and its hardships, and she's desperate to live and to discover life and have adventures. And so the idea of a detective, a lady detective, came to me from that because I thought, that isn't that a wonderful opportunity to get her out there living life and having adventures?
Absolutely. And what was your research process? Did you discover anything really delicious about Victorian Hastings?
I think it's such a rich place, Victorian Hastings. So you can discover it in different ways. Obviously, there's lots of books. There's some really good books about murders in Hastings. I've forgotten the name of the author, but she's very lovely, and she's written two books about murders, which have all sorts of juicy details about unexpected deaths in the past. There are loads of junk shops and antique shops, obviously, that you can wander in and out of and get lots of books and ideas and the feeling. And I think that's the special thing about Hastings, is that you can wander around and still feel that very strong Victorian vibe. There's so many things that still exist, from the West Hill lift to the fishermen's huts on the seashore. So you can get a really strong sense. You don't have to always be looking researching books in the past, because you can get that strong sense when you walk around. And so that was lovely to do for the book. And I even stayed there as a Victorian guest house. In Hastings, where they've recreated the rooms as they were in Victorian times. It's called St. Benedict's, I think. So I stayed the night and had a silver service breakfast there as well.
How wonderful. I'd love to know, Hannah, if you always knew that this was a two-book series, did you plan them together?
I didn't actually. I wrote the first one as a standalone, and then my publishers liked it so much, they asked me for a second one. And for that reason, it was slightly harder to write, because I hadn't left myself so many openings, not thinking of it as a two book series. But actually, that worked really well, and there was plenty more for Valet to be doing.
I'd love to know about your journey to publication. How did you go from idea to book on a shelf and winning awards?
So I've been writing a Victorian book for quite a few years, and my heroine was having quite a miserable time, and I was trying to be literary and serious and edgy, and it wasn't really working for me, and the writing wasn't flowing, and as any writer will know, I was just sort of filling notebooks with endless, not much at all. And then I spotted the Comedy Woman in Print Prize, which is run by the comedian Helen Lederer, and just for a laugh, I decided to enter three chapters. And what I discovered when I was writing those chapters was, and trying to be funny or setting myself free to be funny, was that that set my writing free as well, and I absolutely loved it. And then I got shortlisted, and then came second, joint second in the prize, which was fabulous. And that helped me get an agent, and then it helped me get a book deal not long afterwards as well. So it will happen very quickly, and I do feel very lucky about that. I don't think it's always as easy or quick as that for everyone.
Absolutely, but it's a really good reminder for anyone listening who is interested in getting their work published that entering competitions is a really, really good way to get your work out there.
It is, and actually, I had to submit the full book when I was longlisted. I had to submit the full book for consideration within about 2 or 3 weeks, and it wasn't by any means ready. But that having that pressure, and there was nothing to lose really, and so having that pressure and that it set my writing free. I just had to get the words down. There was no faffing about whether it was the right word or not. I just had to write, and I really think that helped me as well. So sometimes having that motivation is a great thing.
Absolutely. I'd really like to know what authors inspire you as a writer and if they write the same kind of things that you do.
There's lots of fellow comedy women in print authors who are great and really funny. There's Nancy Peach, who's just written a book called Hot Mother, and Kathleen Wyman, whose books include Wife Support System. And so there's lots of really good fellow authors who are out there and who we have built up a bit of friendship and companionship, which is lovely. I'm also obviously really fond of books set in the past as well. One of my favourite authors is Mary Stuart, who is not as famous as she should be, but very well loved by those who know her. She wrote what you might call romantic suspense, and it's really just about a heroine who goes off and has a great adventure. And unlike many, they were written in the 1960s, and unlike many heroines who were slightly scared or stupid or jealous or just not very positive portrayals of women in those days, Mary Stuart's heroines are very kind of go-getting. They drive fast cars and they solve murders and they fight with criminals, and they're just much more inspiring. And Mary Stuart herself is just a fabulous storyteller.
What are you working on next, Hannah? Are you going to continue with the Victorian era and with cozy crime, or are you taking a shift in your writing?
So I think that's probably it for the Violet Hamilton series for now. Not that I might not come back to her later, but at the moment I'm having great fun writing what you might call a funny gothic, and it's a bit of a mixture of Cold Comfort Farm and Jane Eyre, and it's kind of taking that gothic trope of governess, and people in the attics, and kind of all those kind of gothic things, and then making that funny. And I'm just having a fabulous time writing about hermits and castles and falling down buildings and all sorts. There's all sorts going on in it, so it's just something that's given me a great deal of fun.
It really sounds fabulous. And one thing that I've really noticed is that writing humour is so great to read, writing funny things, but can be really, really difficult to get right as a writer. How do you kind of make sure that your writing is funny to other people and that your jokes land?
I think it's probably best not to think too much about what other people expect humor to be and just think about what makes you laugh and reconnect with that playful side that we all have when we're young, when we're free to play and we don't care about the consequences. So allowing yourself to be silly, and allowing yourself to be free and put down the daftest things you think of without with and it does require a level of vulnerability and a level of opening yourself up, because I think through life that kind of gets dampened down by growing up. But actually, if you can reconnect with that self that just lets you write what delights you and what makes you laugh, I think that then that will connect with the reader as well.
I would really like to know, Hannah, to talk a bit about your career before you became an author. What were you doing until you became a writer? And then what have you really observed about becoming a writer that you really had no idea about before?
So for a long, long time, I did study creative writing at university, which is now 30 years ago or so. But since then, I've m moved into a career in PR, and I have been lucky enough to work in some fabulous places. So I worked at the National Museum of Scotland in Edinburgh for about 12 years, and then I've worked for Buckingham Palace and the Royal Horticultural Society. And things like that. So I've had just worked in really interesting places, which are packed full often of fascinating stories. So I think I have mined those places for material over the years, just because museums and galleries and gardens have such fascinating things, and history and past and people stories as well. So that's been absolutely fabulous.
The second part of my question was, what have you observed about, becoming a published writer and the publishing industry, which you might not have had any idea about before you entered into it?
I think you do have to learn to enjoy it for the writing and not be too bothered by the noise that comes with it. So you build a certain amount of resilience and keep on going no matter what happens to you. Not every book you write may be a bestseller, and I think the most important thing and the most important feedback that you can get is actually from your readers. So I've had some wonderful feedback and reviews and from people with whom my novels are really, really connected. And so I think it's important to focus on what's important for you as a writer rather than being too distracted by all the publishing noise that goes on around it. Otherwise, it might throw you off the thing you're good at, which is writing. So you could spend half a day on social media or, be distracted by everything else that goes along around it, whereas really your skill and your talent and the joy that you have is in the writing.
That's really great advice. Hannah, thank you so much for joining us. How can people find and follow you and get their hands on a copy of your books?
So my books are available in most good bookshops and on Amazon and various websites as well. That it's in quite a few independent bookshops, so I'd always recommend independent bookshops as well. And I am on Twitter as Lady Dolby, of course. And on Instagram, I think I'm either Dolby Hannah or Hannah Dolby. I get confused with which, but I'm on Instagram as well, so you can find me quite easily. I do have a website as well, which is hannahdolby.net.
Thank you so much for joining us. Hannah's books, No Life for a Lady and How to Solve Murders Like a Lady, are out now with Head of Zeus. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show today. We will be back next month with another jam-packed episode of all things books and writing in Brighton, Sussex and the surrounding areas. Make sure you are following us over on Instagram at BTN Book Club. And if you've got an idea for the show, do send it over. We'd love to hear from you. It's at btnbookclub@gmail.com. We will see you next month.